Welcome in, everyone, to episode 35 of Bruins Tape to Tape. I am your host tonight, Maria from Watertown. I'll be joined by my ever so positive and cheery co-host, Caroline. And we're also excited because we have another guest with us tonight who's graciously given of his time to join us in a conversation surrounding the Boston Bruins. Tonight, setting the table is not going to be too difficult, folks. We're going to talk about some of the good that came out of those games in Toronto last week. But sadly, we are likely going to be talking about the million-dollar question of, is history repeating itself with our Boston Bruins and closeout games at home? But before we take a deep dive into that, I'd like to introduce our guest, Brian DeFelice, who is a former producer at WEI, but he's also now one of three co-hosts of the Skate podcast, which is affiliated with WEI, along with his colleagues, Bridget Prue, who was gracious enough to join us last week, and Scott McLaughlin. So you can find all their content on WEEI. So Brian, welcome in. You're joining us at, I don't know if I'll say an opportune time or an inopportune time, but honest to God, what a shit show last night was. That's how I'll start.
Well, there's no other way to start it, Maria. And thank you to you and Caroline for having me on. I saw that you, as you mentioned, Bridget, my co-host with the Skate Pod, was on your last episode, and I just love the fact that the two of you have this show and this platform, and it's wonderful to meet you, Caroline, and for Maria, it's awesome to have you give your Bruins takes in more than just 90 seconds.
Yes!
Right? But
we gotta learn to trim that down a little bit, Brian. We're working on
minutes,
that.
Brian. 90 minutes is what
90 minutes. 90 minutes. 90 seconds is all Maria gets on these stations, and she knows more about hockey than anybody. So, it's a great time to talk. The Bruins obviously lost game 5, but anytime we're talking Bruins playoff hockey, it's never a bad day. So thank you for having me on.
Well, we're looking forward to getting your added insight into, what we saw, because I don't want to take away from the fact that the Bruins did win 2 games in Toronto, and they won them by playing really good, solid, smart hockey. So I'd like to get both of your thoughts and opinions on, all of the things that worked for them in those 2 games, other than, the fact that, Jeremy Swayman's been playing out of his ever-loving freaking mind in this series.
Yeah, I think for me, what I saw, even across all 3 games, in spite of the less than ideal outcome from game 5, I saw a lot of what we now know as the hallmark of that Bruins culture, where you've got the right attitude, that we're not giving up. Now, granted, that's not what happened, obviously, in game 5. What we had in game 5 was kind of the terribleness that periodically would crop up during the season, where all of a sudden it was as if they were just completely incompetent. And what makes it so frustrating is we know how good they can be because we had the 2 previous games. But what I still saw, in spite of all of that, and I think what really makes this team different than last year, because we all know that the primary talking point from end of the game last night all through today and until puck drop tomorrow is what's happened in the past. And this team is built a little bit differently because this year they experienced real adversity. They had to go through those ebbs and flows. And what we saw across those 3 games is exactly what they've experienced all season. Even though they didn't start on time with game 5, if you were paying attention to the periods in, like, as individual mini games, you could see progression and the improvement. They quite frankly, as we have seen before, run out of time, and they had some pretty bad puck luck. I'm not excusing some of the garbage plays that we saw, but they were getting better and they were pushing through it and they were trying to solve the problem live. And I will be the optimistic one because I tend to be the one who's optimistic of the two of us.
I should have restarted the introduction. Good cop, bad cop.
Exactly. And you know it's serious if I'm the one coming down raining hellfire. But we've also then see them take situations where they've gone and they've laid a giant egg and then they come back and they have a response game. And so I'm optimistic because this team was built differently than last year's team. I will be optimistic and say we will see that team that we know they can be on Thursday.
Well, I hope so. And if they want success, they're going to have to get back to what they did in games 3 and 4, which was playing a simple, hard-nosed style of game led by their leadership and their best players, which was Brad Marchand in games 3 and 4. And Caroline, you're right. That's the exact opposite of what we had in game 5. And what confuses me is that you have a team where last year you're up 3-1 against Florida, the greatest regular season record in NHL history. Do I think they were the best team in NHL history last year? No, but the record was broken. So there's a ton of pressure. And we all know how that series ended. So going into last night in game 5, you never know if a team's going to win or lose. Both teams are great teams, and you can never assume anybody's going to win. But what you can assume, hopefully, is that you'll bring the effort that's required to win. And it was very surprising to me after how last year unfolded, knowing where it all started to go wrong, which is game 5, that they didn't learn their lesson in at least the effort category. And to your point, the Bruins' MO is work ethic and blue collar hockey, no matter what the roster is on paper. And to not see that in game 5, I was absolutely blown away. And you just can't excuse a lack of effort. So Maria, I know you were in the building because we chatted before that, and I don't know what to say. I'm honestly beside myself. I really am. And now you have all this pressure going into game 6 and game 7. So
You put yourselves there. I was dumbfounded. Mm-hmm. A little. Once I get over my being dumbfounded and shocked, it turned to like, now I'm really pissed off. How are we going potentially down this road again? And I have said it on this podcast on more than one occasion, and Caroline has heard me say it. I'm not sold on Jim Montgomery. And last night's lineup changes is one of the reasons that I am not sold on Jim Montgomery. You had a perfectly good lineup setup going in to game 5 at home. You clearly had to have known that the pressure would be on in getting that, you know, proverbial monkey off your back in closing out game 5. Mm-hmm. Why would you insert Matt Grizzlick into the lineup when you saw the difficulties that he had in the first game on home ice, getting pushed around? This kid, and Caroline, you've said it on more than one occasion, when he plays well, he plays well. When he plays poorly,
it's a disaster.
It's a disaster. Yeah. Okay. And so watching him last night being moved from one side of the ice to the other side of the ice, and seemingly Toronto continuing to target him, to then watch him not be able to box out John Tavares, to not even allow him to get near Swayman, to me, it's infuriating. And then to listen to Montgomery in the post game saying, "We just weren't good enough. We just didn't start on time." Okay, you saw that happening for at least the first two periods. What did you do about it? Why? What did Kevin Shattenkirk do that was so egregious, that was so bad, that you had to pull him out of the lineup to put another player in who you knew has been exposed on more than one occasion? Not all his fault. not all his fault. The only good player on the ice last night for the Boston Bruins was Jeremy Swayman up until that third period. Charlie McAvoy, Pavel Zacha, they've been getting torched in the faceoff dots. Brian, you know a lot more about hockey than I do. You tell me how you're going to control. I don't know. I thought they were like losing them left and right.
Yeah.
Oh, the faceoff?
They can't control the play. If you don't win faceoffs, how are you going to control the play?
Well, right. Yeah. And like I said, Maria, I'm going to push back. I think you know more about hockey than anybody. But in my experience playing and coaching and whatnot, it's definitely not a one versus one situation at the faceoff circle. It's not just the centerman versus each other. It's five guys on the ice. And the wingers have to get in there. The defense, if they have to, you know, jump into the scrum. But yeah, it's a problem. Ultimately, when you're not winning faceoffs at a good percentage, you're not dictating the course of play. And that's what I noticed last night. I mean, far, far too often. I think if I remember correctly from this morning, I think the faceoff was 32 wins for Toronto, 21 for Boston in the game. So just not nearly good enough. And it's a problem. And obviously, we've been so spoiled for two decades with Bergeron and Krejci down the middle. You know, no one expects Zacha and Coyle to be those two with the faceoff percentage, but it's clearly an issue. And to your earlier point about Jim Montgomery changing the lineup after a victory, it's not just the players that have to learn lessons from last year. It's the coaching staff. And what he should have learned is when you win a playoff game, don't change the lineup coming back next game if you don't need to. Obviously, Patrice Bergeron, no one's going to not insert him back into the lineup. But there's the old saying, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And one of the players that he took out of the lineup was Johnny Beecher, who's your best faceoff man. So
to get Brazo in, who had like 10 minutes of ice time. I don't understand it. You had to get him in the lineup so badly that you only played him 10 minutes in that game?
Yeah, it made no sense. And I think, you know, after the games, 3 and 4, I had for our stick taps, Jim Montgomery and his approach to my interpretation. And of course, like, I don't really know anything. I this is my observation. I'm probably reading into it entirely, but my sense was last year when it came to going into the playoffs, you had a coach who was inexperienced at this particular level, maybe falling prey to, and Marie and I have kind of talked about this before, so our listeners will have heard this idea that, you know, call playoffs is the high holy days of the NHL calendar. And there are the traditions and the people who say these are the traditions that you're supposed to follow. And Jim Montgomery's approach to coaching his team last year was brand new, right? The goalie rotation, the mixing of the lines. And so when he got to this point where you've got playoffs, all of a sudden he's being told by these powers that be, the culture of the game, you don't do that. You got to follow the rules. And I think because of his inexperience, decided to go against what he knew was the right thing for his team and his coaching style. And we saw what happened. I was particularly pleased up until the decisions for who to have out there on the ice on game 5. I felt like he was finally saying, you know what? I'm not going to listen to you guys anymore. My team is different. The way I coach is different. We're going to do the rotation. We're going to find these lines, and then we're going to mostly stick to what is working. And then for him to all of a sudden, in one moment, undo that all, that's what made no sense, because I thought that he had learned, no, you should trust yourself. You should trust how you've been running your team all season. Like, the idea that you don't change things for the playoffs, but you can change the tradition. Like, you could do both, right? You can keep things the same and make change at the same time. And that was just, quite frankly, mind-boggling. And, you know, like you said, Maria, all I've seen of Matt Grizzlick especially with Toronto. Toronto's huge. They will always go after him. They will always go and bounce pucks off of him because he's just small. And for whatever reason, this guy does not have it in with the hockey gods, because I don't explicitly blame him for the overtime goal, because I've seen him actually pass the puck right in front of the goaltender and see the puck go in. I'm like, those instances, you're being an idiot. What are you doing? It went off his skate. But of course, whose skate is it going to go off of? Matt freaking Grzelcyk.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. This whole dynamic of being up 3-1, it's even down to the detail. It's, you're up 3-1 against Florida last year, and Matt Grzelcyk is part of the goal along with Linus Ullmark that lets back into the series. And then last night, he was part of it too. And Grzelcyk is an interesting situation, because I've been saying for quite some time, I just don't think he is a top four defenseman, and I don't think he's a top six defenseman in the playoffs. And Scott McLaughlin,
you're absolutely spot on.
Scott McLaughlin, who I do the podcast with at EEI, and he writes for the website and whatnot, he interviewed Matt Grzelcyk not too long ago, and Grzelcyk mentioned that when he plays with McAvoy, he tends to sit back more. And so without saying, like, the insinuation there is that because Grzelcyk's game is puck transportation, moving his feet, and that first outlet pass. And when he tells Scott that when he plays with McAvoy, he tends to sit back because McAvoy is such a dynamic player, that tells me that he's not playing to his ceiling as a player. And I also think that when McAvoy plays with Grzelcyk, it's his buddy for a long time. I think he plays a little conservative. So I don't think the two of them get the best out of each other in the first place. So it confuses me when Grzelcyk sits for a couple of games and then Monty brings it back into game five. How do you go from being on the ninth floor to now being back in the top pair in the third period in overtime last night? It just makes no sense to me.
No, and you made a great point about that on one of your most recent episodes about the Charlie McAvoy and Matt Grzelcyk dynamic. And, you know, I sometimes refer to those types of, you know, player relationships on ice as, you know, each other's binky. And at some point, you got to take the binky away. The kid doesn't need his, you know, their binky anymore. Yeah. And well, you're spot on.
It's like anything in life, right? People say you start to excel when you're outside your comfort zone. I just feel like they're each other's comfort zone, and you don't want Charlie McAvoy playing comfortable. You want him playing on his toes. And so that's why Mason Lauri, people say, well, he's a rookie. He makes mistakes, by the way. All the other defensemen make mistakes too on the Bruins team. But I just think that with Lauri there, he has to be the older brother, right? And he has to step up. And so, look, Matt Grzelcyk he wasn't like the worst player last night. It's just, it was just an unnecessary lineup change, in my opinion.
Yeah, 100%. And it's going to make for an interesting free agency for sure. One thing that I really liked, because again, I'll be the positive one today. I was impressed. Granted, okay, let's be honest. Nobody was impressive whatsoever yesterday. But
Todd Angeli was. That was a great anthem.
Yeah, my God. Both anthems, my God, that was fantastic.
And Derek Sanderson was the banner captain. So that was pretty awesome. Yeah, it was a great start to the night. Yeah, it was a great start to the night.
I tell you who I was pleasantly surprised by, at least in the previous two games. JVR, considering he'd been out for a while, he'd had some kind of illness that noticeably affected him physically. And I've been a fan of his for a while, because I think he serves a very specific role. And so one of the things that we like to talk a lot about is, you know, the hockey team is the workplace, right? And everybody has their job, and you don't want to have too many of the same people doing the exact same job, because then you're going to have deficits in other areas. I love how he has become kind of this new king of the bumper. Now, nobody's going to ever touch Patrice Bergeron. But I was really glad to see him get put in Toronto, because you could see it right away that that's where he likes to camp out and that's where he can get those goals. And if the team is consistently sending those pucks on net, it doesn't matter if they necessarily go in, but if you're going to get those rebounds, he is right there. And that's, he's gotten so many goals in that way. I was really impressed considering all the things that had happened with him in the second half of the season. You know, he's this, an older player who maybe some of his consistency isn't there, but I loved how he came in, and even though he didn't score a goal in his first game, he had that near breakaway chance and then was redeemed the very next day or next game with almost the exact same move. So I really enjoyed seeing him really step up and be in that role, because there's a big hole there without Bergie.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it you know, it seems to me too, and you know, and this is a question we can maybe break down and talk about. Were the Bruins really that bad, or were the Maple Leafs really that much better, or was it a combination of both? Because from what I saw last night, even from my seat high in the balcony, it seemed to me that the Maple Leafs were trying to stay away from all the extracurricular crap that was getting them into trouble on home ice. They did a much better job of not, you know, stirring the pot, so to speak, and poking the bear.
The Leafs? I mean, my take was, I didn't think either team was particularly great. The Bruins are absurdly lucky that Matthews didn't play, because they would have then been really embarrassed.
Yep.
But just as from a hockey fan perspective, I didn't think they were either very, very good. I mean, the Bruins certainly had a lot more chances. That just puck went the wrong way, hit a post, crappy ice, people falling over. It just seemed a little bit like the Leafs were a touch discombobulated, even compared to how I've seen. They didn't seem as organized, I guess. I don't know how to really describe it, but they didn't seem particularly sharp either. And it was, in the end, even though the Bruins were getting better, it was always going to come down to who's going to make the first mistake in front of the net. And that's what happened to the Bruins.
Yeah, I definitely didn't watch that game and think to myself, Toronto's playing so good. It was kind of like Toronto was just playing competent and the Bruins were playing blackout drunk, is what it seemed like.
I wished I had blacked out in the balcony, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I might have been better off than having my daughter say, Mom, I think everyone in the balcony can hear you screaming right now.
Yeah.
I, you know, that's what makes that first period even more seething to me. Aggravating, seething, call it what you want. You're on home ice. You got a goalie playing on the other side who hasn't seen any game action since when, right? It had been a month at least. And you only put two freaking shots on goal on him instead of immediately coming out with a, we're going to just kill him with the forecheck. We're just going to throw pucks on net. We're going to dig putts out and we're going to make him soil himself, right? Mm-hmm. To the point that we're going to plant a seed of doubt in his head. And the longer they went, the Bruins, without doing that, the more confidence Wall got, I think.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean, I think they, to your point, Maria, they had two shots in the first period. They also had two shots in the first period plus, because I don't think they had their third shot until maybe 4 or 5 minutes into the second. So there were no shot attempts may have been like five. It's not like they were getting a ton of blocked shots. They couldn't connect any passes. Their feet weren't moving. There was no cycling. There was no high to low. There was nothing at all. And it's inexcusable. There's no reason for that. Again, Toronto didn't come out on their toes. I just think they just took the mistakes of Bruins. I mean, I was literally watching like Lindholm would just retrieve the puck and just throw it up the glass. There's nobody
there
besides
Toronto. What is going on with him? Yeah. I don't know. And, you know, I know I've been really hard on Monty today, but I think he deserves some of the criticism and you know, some of the blame pie, but like how as a group of core players that, you know, other than Bergeron and Krejci, you still last year, you still had Pasta, you still had Martian, you still had Coyle, you still had Zaka, you still had McAvoy. How, I want to ask you players, how could you allow yourselves to come out in this very situation, okay, so flat? It's not the fact that you lose the game, it's how you lose the game.
Exactly. Yeah. You can, if the Bruins came out here in game five and they threw the kitchen sink at Toronto and they hit five posts or wall was just spectacular, or Toronto just matched, whatever the case may be, and you lose, you can sit there and say, you can tip your hat to them, right? That was, it was not that. The effort was not there from the start.
Yeah.
It wasn't there.
I think for me, when I've seen this team do that, like when they've had, you know, their stretch of 5-10 games where they've had high quality wins or even high quality losses, and then all of a sudden they've got this egg that they lay, I kind of think that it's clearly some kind of the mental game piece, that the sports psychology piece of it, because what I saw almost immediately was a team that was tentative, nervous, scared. And like you said, they literally had nothing to be afraid of because they had nothing to lose. The series wasn't on the line for them. So why are you trying to make sure, like, you're overthinking it? You're trying to make sure that you've got these crazy, beautiful passes or whatever, like you said, moving away from the simple game of hockey because they're afraid that they won't win. Why does this keep happening? Right. Because they have the talent. We have seen it. They're not some crummy team that's on a hot streak like Florida was last year, right? Like, right. Nobody was good trying to win that wild card race last year, just like this year. But Florida got lucky because Bob got hot at the right time and things just took off. This team is not a bad team parading as a good team who's just getting lucky. And I think that's the core of the frustration for most people. And nobody can answer, why were you afraid?
Yeah. And you know, you're not supposed to approach a game five when you're up 3-1 as if you have extra lives to spare. You're supposed to play, especially after last year. It's right. Every game should be game seven. You have to treat it the same way.
Right. Mm-hmm. I've never been, you know, a professional athlete, but I would think the first thought that comes into your head is, this is our game seven, boys. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is our house. This is our game seven. And, you know, we're going to leave everything out there. And, you know, and wherever the chips fall after that, if you come out there and you show me that mindset and that mentality as opposed to what we were seeing. And I can tell you, if I took a poll in section 304 last night after that first period, everyone would have said, here we go again. We're coming back to Boston for game seven.
Oh my God. We're going to do this to house.
It's no joke. It's no joke.
He's like, Bob, because that's game seven. I'm like, Dad.
And how can you not?
Game five.
How can you not feel that way? Well, how can you not feel that way?
If you break it down and you kind of look at it in sections, right? Like, it's right now you say to yourself, okay, they have to lose two more games to lose a series. But if you actually break it down game by game, okay, so now you're going back to Toronto. And there's so much at play here, right? Obviously, like you guys said, Austin Matthews isn't playing. So huge missed opportunity. But Florida beat Tampa already. So now any war of attrition evenness you had with Florida, you've lost now because even in the series, they've been resting. So now you got to go back to Toronto. Mitch Marner kind of answered the bell last night. William Nylander is more comfortable playing in the series. And now does Matthews come back? It's like, okay, so if you lose game six and they come back to Boston for game seven, good luck. It's a battle of the choker.
It's tough.
You know?
One of the questions that Maria and I ask each other sometimes after games like this is, what are you going to look for specifically in the first period that will tell you maybe one way or another the direction that the game is gonna head?
Well, for the Boston side of things, because they played so awful in game five, literally everything.
Everything.
Literally everything. They have to do better.
Well, we know we're going to get good goaltending, right?
Yeah.
Again, it's got to be Swayman, right? There's no doubt, right? We don't even have to debate that, I would think and hope at this point.
Well, Monty always keeps us guessing. You never know with him, but any rational mind would say yes in this situation. But Caroline, to answer your question specifically, I mean, from the get-go last night, their feet weren't moving. They were overpassing. They weren't crisp at all. And I love the excuse of the TD Garden ice is slush. I guess Toronto was playing on a different surface. Basically, you just have to simplify your game. And that's what teams do when they go on the road. You look at the Bruins' home record in recent years in the playoffs, it's not great. I think in their the last 19 home games, they're below 500, like the 9-10. And there's validity to that. You choke up at home, you play more free on the road. So, their feet have to move. And obviously, it's the biggest cliche, but pucks and bodies to the net. It's that simple. You got to play ugly to win in the playoffs.
Yeah. Maria, what are you going to look for?
I'm going to look for a hell of a better effort than I saw the other night. Okay. All the way around. I need to see more. I'm not sure what's going on with Pavel Zacha, but David Pastrnak's been getting, double teamed, as soon as he touches the puck, there are two Leafs on that. So presumably you would think that would open up space for Zacha. And, I'm not quite sure, I had hoped for him to have a big series. And I think I said it on the podcast in one of our episodes that, I was calling for him to have a big series because I thought David Pastrnak would be, contained and not allowed to run free. So, I've got to see more from him and I've got to see Monty just be decisive, commit to your lineup and stick with it.
Yeah. I think even before the game starts, I think the announced lineup is going to signal something. And for me, I got to see that on time start. If that doesn't happen in the first 5 minutes, I think we know the direction that the game is going to go in, that they will only win it if they get very, very lucky in the third period. So, and we haven't really talked about this guy very much. But, Maria, you've made a really good point of something that I haven't really thought of because, like a lot of Bruins fans, I think I've been sitting and watching and waiting. I'm like, okay, come on, David. Come on, let's go. But you're absolutely right about how Toronto has been all over him and not necessarily like physically all over him in terms of, hits and whatever. But there was this one moment last night that I was watching and he wound up to take a shot. And quite literally, he had two Leafs, one guy in front of him and one guy coming right behind him. And as he lifted his stick, the guy behind him just plucked that puck away. And I'm just thinking, oh my God, how did that just happen? But as you now have pointed out, I'm realizing maybe the reason why we haven't seen the level of production from him isn't because something's wrong or, the lack of effort or what have you. It's just he cannot get that space to do what he needs to do. And he's typically, yes, we've seen those moments where, he can go into those tight spaces and maneuver the puck and get it in. That's really what Brad Marchand does. Pasta tends to need to have some free space around him to get those shots and get on net. And he just hasn't had any of that room at all because Toronto has been all over him.
Hopefully soon enough.
Yes, please.
So let's get to that.
Adrian uttered those terrible words not last night, but two nights ago. And I said, no, we do not want to be shouting. We want Florida. No. We're not saying those words. No.
Definitely not. No. But you raise a good point, though, Caroline. I mean, Pasternak, I think, has a tendency to, he's such a good player, such an elite player, that he wants to be able to get his shot off the way he wants to. And I think that you don't have to be behind the defender to get your shot off. I mean, just use him as a screen. Just get it to the net. It's the regular season is so much different than the postseason. You don't have the time and space like you're talking about. So I know it sounds simple and it's so cliche, but you really do. You just have to just get it to the net, get it deep, and simplify your game. You have to do it. There's no matter how much talent you have or skill you have, nobody is an exception to that rule of simplifying your game in the postseason.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, he's not really known for those greasy goals, right? He's spectacular ones. And I think he's just got to figure out how to just don't overthink it. It doesn't have to be perfect every single time. Just
freaking net. And he's too quick to try to cut to the inside. I remember when he was younger, 18, 19, he used to go drive wide a lot. And the older he's gotten, the more elite he's gotten, to his credit. It's almost like he thinks he might be too good at times to just drive wide and go to the net the old fashioned way.
Yeah.
That would benefit him too, like to drive wide on defenders and use his speed. He's too quick to try to go through their legs or do something fancy, and it just doesn't work this time of year.
Crash the net, please.
Crash the net.
I mean, it's such a cliche, term, but it actually works, especially when you have, a night like last night where, you're not being able to generate any sustained offense. Why not? Right? Why not? Just go hard to the net. I don't care if you get called for a penalty. Right at that point, but you're at least showing me, showing yourself, showing your teammates, this is how we need to play. This is how we're going to have to get back in this game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And
Toronto's defensive personnel is not exactly the St. Louis Blues of 19 or anybody that's had a really good defense lately either. They're just, I mean, Joel Edmondson and Timothy Liljegren. Ilya Labushkin, Morgan Riley, Jake McCabe, and Simone Benoit. Has anybody heard of Simone Benoit before this series? Not really.
No.
I mean, I had. I'm being a little facetious, but not before this year, though. I'll be honest. So it's not like that he's playing against these defensive stalwarts either. And if they do get past Toronto, and you play the Floridas of the world, or the Carolinas, or the Rangers with Jacob Trouba and Keandre Miller and others, it's like he's in for a rude awakening.
Yeah. I mean, the old adage that I say literally every pod, it's goalies win cups, defense wins cups. That's the key. And the Bruins should be in a better place than they are, because Toronto doesn't have those things.
So. I expected our best players to be our best players. My expectation, silly me, I thought they would approach it as a game 7 last night for the Boston Bruins. If they don't approach it as a game 7 tomorrow night and our best players are not leading by example, then I have to get concerned about, why are we here again questioning a core, questioning potentially a coach and coaching decisions. Now, again, I know the game hasn't happened yet, but as I said earlier today, when I went off on my tangent on the radio, this is no longer a small sample size with the Boston Bruins and inability to close out games. We're not making this stuff up just because it was one game. It's not one game now, folks. And this happened under Bruce Cassidy's watch, and it's now happening under Jim Montgomery's watch as well.
Yeah.
And the frustrating part is that the Bruins could come out tomorrow night in game six and play a wonderful game.
Yes.
And they still might lose. They might play two great games in the next two games, but maybe Toronto gets lucky or Toronto plays great and you just lose. And it's like you can't just piss away opportunities like they didn't get
a game. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Because we're going to go back. We're not going to have recency bias. Those of us who watch and follow this team, will go back to last night's game and point to that as the turning point. I don't want it to be the turning point, folks. I believe in this team. I want to believe in this team, but they need to give me reason to do so right from the drop of the puck tomorrow night.
Yep.
And last year, to defend Jim Montgomery a little bit, last year.
Yeah.
Is last year the Bruins had so much talent, and at the trade deadline, they brought in Tyler Bertuzzi and Dmitry Orlov and Garnet Hathaway while players like Nick Foligno and Taylor Hall were on injured reserve. And then they kind of came back for playoffs, and then Bergeron and Krejci went down. So you had this massive collection of talent, but a complete rush to try to see where the pieces all fit. In fact, they never had time to see where it all fit. And so there was a lack of chemistry. While they had so much talent, there was a lack of chemistry. And I understood it was when you have so many chefs in the kitchen, Monty's probably like, how do I, what's the best lines? And I could see why last year there was a lot of, you know, changing and lineup changes and whatnot, especially when guys got healthy and stuff towards the end of the year. But this year, it's the opposite. You have a lack of offensive talent on paper. And it really shouldn't be this complicated, especially when you do win a couple games in a row. It should be interesting tomorrow night.
It seems to me. Yeah,
I like to be optimistic, but you know,
I'm listen. You know, I'm fire. You know, it's gonna take me 24 hours or so to work through. You know, I might need Dr. Phil myself before tomorrow night. But it's just, you know, when you know, you see the potential, you know, same scenario that you've seen in the past, and you don't know how you're going to break the cycle. Like, the cycle should have been broken, seemingly, last night.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, and I have to think that, you know, when you put yourself in a situation like that, as you're getting ready for the next game, right? The grip on your stick gets a little tighter. And, you know, if by, you know, some happenstance, Toronto scores the first goal tomorrow night, that stick in your hands, I would think, is going to get even tighter as the game goes along.
Yeah. Well, I think we can all agree that the only fan base that is more traumatized than Boston Bruins fan base is the Toronto Maple Leafs fan base. So
this
is like the perfect storm. We all need to go to therapy because we've all been traumatized by our team's history, right? Like the cynical approach to Bruins fandom is as old as this team has existed, right? My dad has been a fan since the 1950s, and he will just be like, "Well, I've seen this before." It's like, okay, yeah, I know. It's just like the same. It's what it means to be a Bruins fan. But at least I'm not a Leafs fan.
I mean, as we know, the Bruins are celebrating their centennial season right now, so there's a lot of history. But if I could just keep it to the last 20 years or so, right? they blew a 3-1 series lead to Montreal in 2004. They could have won the cup in 2009, and they lost to a Hurricanes team in game 7 in heartbreaking fashion. The next year, they blow 0-3 to Philly. Then they win the cup in 2011, which is the outlier. And then they lose to Washington 2012 in overtime in Boston. They lose to the Blackhawks the way they did. They lose to the Canadiens in 14 in Boston. They lose to the Blues in Boston. There's so much heartbreak, especially in Boston, even in the last 20 years, that outside of 2011, it's the Bruins they're really good at finding ways to break their fans' hearts, you know.
No other team in the history of the NHL has lost more Stanley Cup finals than the Boston Bruins.
Wow.
13 cup losses in the final.
Wow. That is impressive. It's honestly, you got to tip your hat to them for that one. Good for them. They're good at they're the best losers.
They are the best losers.
Does that make them winners?
I guess. They're the number one losers.
Exactly. Everybody gets a trophy. Everybody, we'll give
except
them a minute.
Because they keep losing it.
Jesus.
I will say, in Carolina, I see your jerseys, and Maria, I see your wall of excellence behind you. It's wonderful to follow these teams and whatnot, but if it does make people feel better, win or lose, the sun always comes up the next day, and it's just a game. But obviously, when you're invested in a team, it's, you know, it's a game, but you want them to put their best foot forward. And I can stomach when a team loses because they're not good enough or whatnot. But what I saw last night in game five, especially after what happened last year, nothing pisses me off more than a lack of effort in life. And that's what bothers me the most. And so here we go. We'll see if they can rectify that. But that's what bothers me the most about last night.
So do we want to do any predictions, or are we going to have any jinx scenarios here? Because I already know, I mean, I don't want a game seven, and I'm going with there won't be a game seven because I'm not allowed in the building at game sevens anymore. So.
Well, Caroline, what do you think?
I don't want to see Matt Grizzlick in the lineup, first and foremost. Like, again, I feel terrible saying that. I think we can do it. I think if the team that showed up in Toronto for the other two games, it's going to happen. It has to happen. The Boston Bruins are objectively a better team than the Toronto Maple Leafs. Like, the Leafs are a mess. The culture is garbage. Their coach is an ass. Their main goalie is a sieve.
That's true.
It could happen. But
it should.
Probability doesn't mean certainty, right? So
yeah. I mean, as the pessimist, I suppose, right now, I just think to myself, is what are the odds Toronto just keeps losing at home? Like, every dog fight has their day. But I do think here's my actual fear, my realistic fear. Because I don't think the Bruins are going to have a stinker like they did last night. I think they're going to come out and they're going to give it an honest effort. My biggest fear is that they're going to play great and still lose and then go home and have all the pressure of the world on them to be. I mean, 90% of teams win a series when they're up 3-1. If the Bruins are on the verge of being in that 10% back-to-back years, that's a big weight on their shoulders in game seven. So I'm hoping that they're inspired enough to not let it get to that point and that they take care of business tomorrow night.
Yep. And we've seen them come back from those games and do exactly that. So there is that track record, at least in the regular season, mm-hmm. for as much as that may count. But
so, Maria, what do you think? Are they going to win, or are they going to get a heart attack on next Saturday, this coming Saturday?
Any chance?
I just can't even think about it right now. I just can't even
recovery.
Are think you about it? Because I just don't even know what I would do with myself all day. I mean, I do have a tea time on Saturday, so I pity the golf course that I'm going to be on if there's a game seven on Saturday night.
That poor 9-iron. It's going to be snapped in half.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I've been known to fling a club here or there and my time on the golf course. So, again, you know, I want to believe that there's enough in that locker room. There's enough leadership in that locker room to not allow history to repeat itself. And as you said, right, you give me 110%. And you leave it all on the ice, right? If by chance you don't win that game, then I'm not going to have as big of an issue. Mm-hmm. But you just can't put yourself in a mindset of here we go again. They just cannot allow themselves to do that.
Mm-hmm. Right. Exactly. So. We'll just have to wait and see.
We will. We'll have to Maria, we'll have to have you go to Greg's, get a nice chicken marsala, you know, and sit back on the couch and relax and watch the game. Caroline, what did you have? Was it a burrito before? Or
no, it was a pizza.
All pizza. Well, okay. Good choice.
I might need a bucket of wine right next to me, though.
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a sober person in our Discord chat tomorrow night. So I'm pushing all my Friday meetings to the afternoon.
There you go.
The morning's going to be rough.
Well, hopefully they pull it out, and then we can be talking about a round two. But until then, it's fingers crossed and holding our breath because, you know, they haven't given us reason to believe that they can close out series, especially with this group. I mean, they haven't won a playoff series in 3 years. So, in a while.
Not a great, you know, and you know, again, and you know me, right? I'm being optimistic now. Hold the phone, folks. The law of averages, right? I look at that as the law of averages. At some point, it's got to turn around in your favor, right? It's a small thing to hang your hat on, but I have to hang my hat on something at this point in time.
I feel like a Toronto podcast could say that with more conviction, though, because they really haven't had anything. They're probably saying the same thing, you know?
They got nothing.
Speaking of podcasts, when's your next episode dropping? Are you going to do a pregame or a postgame?
We usually, during the regular season, we do 3 times a week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. But during the playoffs, we're typically going the morning after a game. So our next episode should be Friday morning after game.
Awesome.
After game 6.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the platforms that folks can find the podcast on?
Yep. So Apple, Spotify, the WEI website, Twitter, YouTube, all the goodies everywhere, pretty much. Yep.
All the places.
Yeah. What's the phrase? Wherever podcasts are found, whatever. Is that what people say?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. It's everywhere. Yeah. There's no exclusivity anymore.
It's probably on platforms I don't even know about. So
exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Someone's probably pirated and is making money off you guys.
Oh,
and you
don't.
I bet they are. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's always fun to talk hockey with, you know, anyone who's as excited about the Bruins as we are. So
and we appreciate your time. We appreciate your insight and, you know, educating us too on the X's and O's of the game. So always very helpful for, you know, the two of us who are novices at this gig. So
yeah, no, hey, well, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and I'm glad you guys have this show and the platform, and keep it going, keep working hard. I love it. Thank you so much.
That's our goal. Hopefully the Bruins will have the same mission and the same goal tomorrow night. Just work hard, keep it simple. We'll leave it at this. Keep it simple and work hard, Bruins. It's all we can ask of you.
Absolutely.
Yep. Keep it stupid simple. KISS. That's my favorite acronym.
Absolutely. I love it.
Simple. Yep. Thank you, guys.
As always, until next week, hopefully we have something good to talk about. And go Bees.
Go Bruins.